Hello and welcome to the Android Developers Backstage podcast. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
And I'm Rafe Levine. I'm on the Android UI Toolkit team also.
Excellent. And Rafe is here today to talk about
fonts, text, text layout, and maybe a couple of other things.
We could get into some audio stuff. That's just kind of a teaser. We'll just put it out there and then we'll completely forget to get to it by the end of the episode.
Sounds good.
So I think I knew your name before Android. That's because you did the font in Consolata.
That's absolutely correct.
Popular programming font.
Yeah. So that was actually part of my PhD research on font design tools. And of course, you can't do tools without, you know, making a font with them. And kind of the concept of in Consolata is that I wanted to, most programming fonts are really kind of aligned to a pixel grid. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, this is going to be obsolete. Back then it was crazy thought, but it's like someday there are going to be like devices that have 200, 300, 400, even 500 EPI screens.
Wow.
And so
crazy talk.
Yeah. So I did a lot of kind of very natural curves and kind of subtle modulations, which if you're rendering it at 100 DPI, just it doesn't really render. And so I'm really, you know.
So this font is basically like vector-based then? It's not, you didn't sit and put pixels on a grid. You basically did mathematical definitions of each letter.
That's right. It's an outline font. And part of the PhD research was most fonts are designed with Bezier curves, which are very kind of simple mathematical structures.
And but I was that's not simple. Good enough for a PhD.
Yeah, three control
no,
points, not enough.
No,
yeah.
No. So this font is actually made entirely out of spirals.
And
what? Yeah. Epicycles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Spirals.
It's, okay.
It's not epicycles.
What do you mean by spirals?
Just that. So basically, you know, a spiral is a curve that has a continuous change of curvature.
Okay.
And so Beziers can have kind of abrupt or not very natural changes in curvature because they're not really designed. You know, an experienced font designer will smooth that out. But you know, I wasn't an experienced font designer. I was just, you know, first time, you know, and so I was like, I need a better tool for this, and so the spiral has this very smooth change of curvature.
And it's a monospace font, right? Because we use it for programming. Was that just to make it easier so that you could finish your thesis?
No, that was basically because I, you know, there's like thousands and thousands of fonts out there that, you know, occupy your classical niche of sans serif and serif and stuff like that. And
Comic Sans.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, really fine choice, excellent.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in the monospace category at the time, there were very few like really good, you know, like typography, you know, class fonts. These days there's actually some really good ones that have come out after, like Ubuntu, source code. Both of those are also open source. So as is in Consolata.
I think Courier was sort of the standard for a long time, and then the stunning development was then we had Courier New.
Yeah.
Apparently, with the namespace ran out, and we just started tacking new onto everything.
Yeah,
but that was the main thing, and then I started seeing in Consolata more.
Yeah,
how many characters did you actually draw? I mean, I assume that you didn't do the
26.
Entire Unicode set, right? So,
no.
Like, did you just do the English letters plus the digits, or did you go and do some of the extended?
They're probably around 200, 250. So it's basically. The Latin 1 character set, and then I added some more for Eastern Europe. But in Consolata,
oh, that's Scandinavia.
That's Scandinavia is pretty well covered by Latin 1.
Right.
So,
I'm curious actually how this thing got from a PhD thesis, which tends to be known by the advisor and the student who suffers it, into actually being a widely adopted and used font.
Well,
so how did you get, what was your marketing department like?
My marketing department was, you know, posting it to the internet as open source. And, you know, I've always been interested in open source. You know, before this, I was working on GhostScript, which is a widely used tool for PostScript and PDF.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm pretty connected to the open source community. It wasn't too hard to find users, and I get, you know, emails, you know, a steady stream of people saying, oh, thank you for this font. I use it. I like it. So.
And do you use it yourself in your daily work?
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
All
right.
People love free stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. So you took us back in the depths of time immediately. Actually, the GhostScript thing is also interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I want to find out about that.
Yeah.
So yeah, Go.
GhostScript, wasn't that?
Go.
That whole
Ghost.
Was that the one that could render PostScript files?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So it started life as, you know, a PDF interpreter. I mean, a PostScript interpreter, in fact. That's well before PDF even existed. And, you know, it was open source and ran on, like, a huge variety of systems. So lots and lots of users. And then it kind of evolved. Like, PostScript is kind of fading, and PDF is really the standard that's supplanting it. And so I think that probably most of the people that use GhostScript use it for the PDF capabilities now.
Oh, so it also renders PDFs?
Yeah, it does rendering and it does conversions. So you can convert from PostScript to PDF, or you can go from PDF to PDF and change things like, you know, image compression. If you want to make like a mobile optimized version of the file,
The one thing I always wanted was to take, you know, this document that was 50 pages and do 4 up, right? So that I don't have to print it onto 40 pages, maybe 10 instead.
Yeah. So there's some tools in there for that kind of PDF editing, but usually you'll use a PDF editing tool for that.
And PostScript was heavily vector-based, right? So they're also using like Bezier curves everywhere, path rendering stuff.
Yeah.
So was that sort of a link to then the work that you did in your PhD was just continued work with path curve technology?
Absolutely.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So
what do you do on Android?
Yeah. what are we doing here?
Yeah. I work on basically anything that touches fonts, text rendering, text layout, some of the text editing, kind of taking the characters and making them into the pixels that you see on the screen.
I have always thought that working on text is character building. What I've actually noticed, so I've worked on several platforms, and I've always noticed that the person that works on text and particularly font technologies is the person who does everything there. Like you are either a font person or you are not. And there's like a deep chasm that you fall into, and some people go willingly, like you apparently did, or maybe you just rationalize it to yourself. Mm-hmm. But you are, in fact, are that person or one of those people who have taken that on.
It is a fairly specialized area, and it's just something that I've always been interested in my whole life. My dad, among other things, was a book publisher. And so when I was growing up, he had
I have a lot of spine for that.
The puns are just coming.
Yeah, oh boy, I got to keep up here. But when I was growing up, there were like specimen books of fonts just lying around. So like, you know, I like to say like, you know, that when I was growing up, it's like A is for Albertus, B is for Baskerville. You know, that was my alphabet book.
I imagine your dad like with a printing press putting out Gutenberg Bibles. Is that pretty much what it was like?
No, not so much that. He did actually do a miniature Bible. He was into miniature books. One of the things that he was fascinated by was really small type and really making type that people could read. And you know, that's actually relevant today because people are putting type on these kind of small screens, you know, even like watch faces. And so you have to make it legible.
I was just remembering the other day, I think the Oxford English Dictionary that was out when I was a kid, like it came with a magnifying glass because they were putting so much information in this thing that you were still supposed to pick up that the print was so small you had to use this glass for.
Yeah.
Maybe we should actually be shipping these devices with magnifying glasses.
Yeah, I basically, like I have glasses and like I put them on when I want to like, you know, really get into the device.
So when you have a monitor, do you prefer to have really high density on it, or do you use like the large fonts to get just really crisp fonts?
I have a big screen. I have a 30-inch monitor.
Right, and do you make the fonts large on those, or do you just have, you know, 600 character lines in your source code editor?
I kind of use a medium size font, yeah.
So the area that you talked about actually spans a lot of different sub pieces, right? There's rasterization, which I think you've worked on in the past.
Yeah.
Currently, rasterization actually is handled elsewhere, the skier renderer.
Well, actually, most of the rasterization happens in the FreeType library, which is kind of the standard library, and then skia is the layer that kind of abstracts that.
Okay. So that was kind of handled even before you were on the team, was sort of the rasterization of turning those characters into bitmaps that we then copy around.
Right? Exactly.
But then there's a lot more involved with actually handling it. Then there's the string, there's the measurement of the string, there's choosing the font based on what locale.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I don't know. Can you break it down any more legibly than I have?
Legibly? I don't know about that.
It's about fonts and text.
Yeah.
Let's make it readable.
Sure. All right.
Well, there's this process of, you know, when you have two adjacent characters in some languages, you use different characters based on what those two pairs are, right? Where does that happen?
Yeah, so that happens. So there's a lot, as you say, there's a lot of different layers, a lot of different levels of this stuff. So there's the rasterization of making fonts into the bitmaps. Then there's the drawing of the text, which is basically taking those bitmaps and putting them on the screen. And that's not my area. Like Roman Guy did a great post on Medium that would be really great to check out if you're interested in that part, because it's all about GPUs and, you know, really making that fast, really making that happen at 60 frames a second.
Glyph cache.
Yes.
But the anti-aliasing, that would happen in the rasterization?
That's in the rasterization part. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So then there's the complex text layout or complex script layout. And so in English, it's not too complicated a problem. You do see it, like, for example, the FI combination. Usually there's a ligature, which is the name for that, that is both F and I. And so if your string has something FI, then the complex text processor says, okay, that should be one character for that, and it chooses that character, and then, you know, later down in the pipeline draws that. But in other languages like Arabic and Hindi and so on and so forth, the rules are super complicated, and there's lots and lots of ligatures. There's reordering so that you actually will put a vowel before a consonant, it kind of comes in the logical order, the speech order, but it gets rendered out of order. And then there's marks, like for vowels, there's, you know, a lot of times the vowel would be placed above or below the consonant. And so there's actually like very complicated rules that depend on the language, depend on, all kinds of subtle things. And then, of course, the font itself. So this is another whole area of providing the set of fonts that are used to render all these languages. And make it so that the font and the complex text layout engine kind of work together as a system, that they have to kind of be compatible with each other in order to get good results.
So the platforms generally come with a set of fonts, right, which are supposed to then cover a wide spectrum of what applications might need. And then different devices that are for sale in different countries may actually come with a different set of that, right? Set of those fonts. And then depending on what character they are using in a string will choose a particular font, or do they specify the fonts by name or by type?
Well, both, all of the above, actually. So we provide, as part of the Android platform, first of all, Roboto, which is kind of the signature brand font. And Roboto covers Latin, Greek, and Cyrillic. So that's, you know, that's a lot of our users, but it's far from all of our users. And then Roboto comes in, I think there's 18 different variants of it, which are italic and normal, and then the different weights. So there's thin, light, normal, medium, bold, and black. And then there's also a condensed and three weights of that that's used in, you know, sometimes you want a little bit more density of information.
Do they actually call the heaviest weight black?
They do.
And if you render that in white?
They used to call it fat, but we had complaints about that. It's sort of politically incorrect. So
I see.
Maybe we should just go with ultra, which is the other, you know.
ultra mega font.
Yeah. But black is what it's called even when it's rendered in, you know, reverse video or, yeah. So that's Roboto. And then there's a whole other set of fonts, most of which are under the kind of Noto brand, which is the Google internationalization effort. So those fonts are on both Android and Chrome OS, and they're all open source. You can download these and put them on your personal computer as well.
And do they have the same feel as Roboto then?
Yes, they're designed to be stylistically compatible with Roboto and also technically compatible, that you have to have the heights, the measurements of the fonts have to be consistent. Otherwise, if you have mixed, like English and some other language, that it would look all, you know, inconsistent. And so there's a lot of work that goes in both the design and the engineering to make all these things work together.
I remember when Roboto first came online, which was that ICS?
That was Ice Cream Sandwich.
Then there was slight changes to metrics, and I was thinking, how is this ever going to work?
Yeah.
Because once you change the size of text, once you say change the size that it's measured at, then you change the size of the view that contains it, then that affects the layout of the container it's in, and then it propagates through the whole system. I was kind of wondering how it would all magically work. But
yeah.
Turns out, you know, this is why we have a flexible layout system, so that it can actually handle sort of subtle changes in the hierarchy and do the right thing.
Absolutely. And it also helps, you know, when you completely like redefine the visual style of the platform, that what happened with Holo and what happened with Material Design, that we can change those metrics and it kind of gets folded in to all the other kind of massive changes that are happening
right.
visually.
So people are going to be rebuilding their apps anyway,
exactly.
So they're
going
to have an opportunity to see what it looks like on devices.
But the responsive design, that really is a central part of designing typography for Android, and it's really important because, among other things, you will have visually impaired users or people who just prefer a different size of font. And they can go into the settings and configure, you know, large or huge font or tiny if they want more density in there. They're not one of those eyeglass wearers. That the design, you know, really does adapt. If you do the design correctly, then the layouts change to give more or less space to the text as needed.
We ellipsize very beautifully.
Yes.
It's very important that developers not use DP but SP.
Yes.
For their dimensions, right, when you set font sizes, because SP will scale with the user's preferred font size. So if you go into your settings and you say, I want to use large fonts, the SP size will actually increase, you know, the way it resolves, whereas the DP does not.
Exactly.
S standing for?
I think it's scalable.
Or scaled. And D standing for don't use.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. D stands for device independent.
Yeah. I always get confused, frankly, because one of them came on first. Was it DIP? And then we switched to DP?
Yeah.
All the other units used two characters, and then DIPs had three. And so, you know, they made DP be an alias, and then now we're basically telling people to use DP.
But generally, the rule is that for elements that are text, you want to use SP, so they scale with the user's font size preference. And for pretty much everything else, you use DP, which just scales with the physical resolution of the device, which most of the time developers, you know, don't really need to care about,
right.
Unless you're addressing individual pixels like me.
Right. So one more question on the different fonts that we supply. So you said we have bold and italic and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if these fonts are all mathematically derived from spirals.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of the ones that we ship on Android are Beziers.
Yeah. So does that mean that, you know, like an italic font is just basically a mathematical operation on those curves, like a shear or whatever? Or like, is it bold? Is that just increasing the stroke size? Mm-hmm. Or is there much more involved in that?
Really good question. So the answer is both. That's usually the answer for text questions. That for the Roboto font family, we have separate fonts for all of the weights, and we have separate fonts for the italic. And the reason for that is that you can do these transformations. And for a lot of the other fonts in the Noto set, we'll have either just normal and bold or just the normal. And then we'll use these mathematical transformations to shear them so they're italic, or to add a stroke offset to change the weight. But they're very subtle things that, like, these crazy type designers, you know, look at, and they say if you shear an O, for example, that it actually makes some of the stroke a little bit thicker and some of the stroke a little thinner, depending on where it is in the on the circle. And so they'll go back and they'll say, well, we're going to adjust these outlines to compensate for this so that it optically looks really excellent. And so that's part of what happens in the code. Is that you have this rather complex set of fonts that has different characteristics depending on which script you're in. And so that's actually one of the things that, if you're interested in digging into the code of the platform, that's something that's brand new in L and Lollipop called Minikin, which is a library that takes your text and takes your attributes, like what weight, what size, if there's other things you want to do, like a stretch or a letter space, add more space between glyphs, which is also new in Lollipop. It goes in and then says, okay, based on this text and the fonts that are available and these attributes, let's choose. Let's draw this span of the text in this font, this span of the text in this font. This span will use the font, but will apply like the shear for italics. So if you've got a mixed string, very common, you might have completely different fonts and completely different transforms going on to get that drawn. And Minikin is the layer that really manages that.
So I was remembering some API, is it internal or external, the fake bold from Skia? Is that actually in the Canvas API as well?
Yeah, it's in the Canvas API. So most of the time, it's going to automatically be invoked. Like if you only have one weight of the font, which it, for example, for our Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, then if you ask for bold, it will internally apply the fake bold.
Okay.
But if you want to explicitly ask for it, like a lot of these parameters that you can change, there's APIs where you can mess with them yourself.
Okay, and then that dates back to the days when we were shipping far less fonts, so you didn't really have the opportunity to use a font that had, you know, a specialized bold or italic. For getting quality italics, I just like to tilt my phone by about 10 degrees, and then it does sort of an automatic physical shear.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. It's rough on the screen, though, if you shear the screen with too much.
it's true.
Can you talk a little bit about text view and sort of what level that is versus what Canvas text does?
Yeah, absolutely. So Canvas text, is about just drawing a string. One of the things that Canvas text doesn't know how to do is break a paragraph into multiple lines. Like your screen is only so wide and you might have a sentence or paragraph that's much wider than that. So that's one of the many things that text view does. So it's a higher level primitive, and it really is, super easy to use. You can just create a text view, say this is the string, you can add XML attributes for your, weights and other, other attributes. And it takes care of figuring out how much space that's going to take on the screen, all of the kind of, wonderful things the Android view hierarchy does.
So did you say there was some new line-breaking work that went into Lollipop?
There is new line-breaking work in Lollipop. So this affects mostly languages other than English, that usually in English, if you have a sentence, you want to break it at a word boundary, which is a space. So it's pretty easy to just find out where those space characters are. But a lot of other languages don't really use, like Chinese and Japanese and Thai don't use space. And so you have to use kind of knowledge of that language. And then there are other rules for punctuation, which before Lollipop we weren't getting quite right. Now we use the Unicode standard to know where those line breaks are, and we use dictionaries to know where the words actually are. So you get much higher quality line breaking, and that's super duper important, especially in small form factors like Android Wear.
Well, even English could benefit from hyphenation, right?
We don't do hyphenation in Lollipop.
Oops. All right. That seems like an opportunity for future work.
It does indeed.
We need things to do in the future.
Yeah.
Because we're just running out. So actually, the thing you mentioned about the other languages reminds me. So we've done a lot of stuff in the last few releases around internationalization. Like any platform, when it starts out, you run really fast and you do what you can to actually get it out there. And then over time, as it's clear that people are using the platform and you want to make it more robust and feature full, then you need to add in the stuff to make a full featured platform. And so remind me what we did. We added BiDi text support in what release was that?
Was 17. API 17.
ICS, 17? Honeycomb?
I think it was Jelly Bean.
Jelly Bean, okay. Yeah. And then there was BiDi layout support that was a follow-on? Or was that same release?
So BiDi, Jelly Bean had BiDi, but not all of the APIs, because there's so much that you can control, because there's a layout direction, there's a text direction, there's gravity, and all of these things interact. And it can really be quite complex if you have mixed right to left and left to right in the same layout. And so I think it was 18, I think it was Jelly Bean MR1,
okay,
where we gave more of those APIs for really fine-grained control of like layout direction.
I thought the tech stuff came in earlier though. Like I thought the API 17 thing was the actual layout direction stuff, like start versus left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was talking about. I didn't realize there's something else.
Well, there's the tech stuff that was based on HarfBuzz.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought that had come in earlier. So we actually did better support for international fonts and text.
As long as you didn't want to render it from right to left.
And then we worked on the layout stuff in Jelly Bean.
Yeah. Well, Jelly Bean was my first release on the Android team. So for the early history, it's, you know.
The world started at Jelly Bean.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, and then there was more development on it in Lollipop with the line-breaking stuff that you were talking about. Or is there other stuff in Lollipop that people would want to know about?
Yeah, definitely. So I do want to talk a little bit more about the line-breaking. Mm-hmm. In terms of new features in Lollipop, so the main thing is just this hugely increased support for scripts. So we support most of the index scripts. We now support traditional Chinese, Hong Kong Chinese, as well as simplified Chinese.
What didn't we support before? Pretend that I'm not a font expert.
Okay, all right. Simplified versus traditional Chinese. So
were the fonts not available, or just the capacity for actually dealing with the fonts if they were there?
Both, yeah.
Okay.
So Chinese and Japanese is real interesting because they all come from the same source, which I think was China. And then, you know, in different regions, they kind of evolved in slightly different directions. So when the Unicode Consortium was trying to kind of define how do you specify all of these languages of all of the world, the Chinese, Japanese, and Korean was a really difficult problem because they were so similar, but also slightly different. If they were really different, then you say, okay, they're different scripts. If they're exactly identical, then no problem. So this was in between. So they decided to unify. So you basically use one Unicode character to represent a character, whether it's Chinese, simplified, Chinese traditional, or Japanese. But the appearance that the user wants to see is different in those depending on your region. So we use the locale to decide which font to use. And other like, for example, in Devanagari font, which is used in, you know, Hindi and Marathi and many other languages in India, we'll use the locale to pick out different characters, like your digits might look different or your, you know, certain letters might look different. So we use that locale to really fine-tune the appearance. It'll still be legible if your locale is wrong, but it'll look way better. Users will really prefer it if that locale is set correctly.
This is a locale that's set by the user on the device or by the developer in the application?
Yes, to both.
Okay.
That's kind of a theme here, isn't it?
Yeah.
And in fact, that's really one of the things that I would ask developers to do. If you have a multilingual application, like kind of a classic example would be a dictionary where you're saying, you know, the word for this is that, then if you know what the language is of the text you're displaying, you should call setTextLocale on the text view or on the canvas, depending on how you're drawing that text. And we will use that locale. This did not used to be the case. This is really new stuff that we're doing this fine tuning. We will use that text locale to choose the font. We will use it to adjust the appearance of characters within the font. And we will also use it to choose the correct line breaking. Because the rules for line breaking are different in different languages.
So make sure I understand, this is when you are displaying text that is not whatever the user's locale is.
Exactly.
It's when you are showing some foreign, potentially, language.
That's exactly right. So the user will set a locale, and of course we respect the user's locale as the default, and we hope that most of the time that's correct. But there are an awful lot of users out there that are multilingual, that are fluently, you know, switching between English and Hindi or between Japanese and Chinese. And those are the cases where if the app has knowledge that goes beyond what the just user's default setting is, that they should be conveying that to the text system so the text system can really do the best job of displaying that text.
So set text locale, that's a method on
Canvas and text view, that's what okay. I heard.
Yes.
Is there also an XML attribute for that, or are you really?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I think there's an XML attribute on it, but I'd need to go back and check.
By the time you hear this, we will have added it.
Excellent.
Well, because we're not going to publish this episode for 4 years.
but a lot of times the language that you're displaying is dynamic. If you have like a, you know, dictionary, you know, you're going to have a drop down of, you know, what am I translating from, what am I translating to. And for those dynamic things, you really want to set it through the program API call rather than just static.
Right.
All right. So that was a lot about line breaking. Line breaking changes.
Yeah. Um,
other stuff in Lollipop, or is that the
yeah?
Main?
So the other thing is we're really trying to push on typography, and material design is just a huge advance in, you know, the whole visual design of mobile systems, and it's really fantastic to work with the designers on this team. And typography is a really important part of that, and so the weights and the control of weights. So you know, you'll use like sans serif thin, sans serif light. And it will do a much better job of, you know, choosing the right font for that weight. It used to be, for example, that if you said sans serif light and then add a bold span, that it would apply that fake bold attribute. Now it says, we've got a font for that. Let's use that font, and you get the true font for that weight.
And this is the Minikin stuff that you would add.
This is part of Minikin, yeah.
Do you remember what the guidelines are for when to use these, like lights and all that?
So there's a spec for material design. So there's a lot of different contexts. So you really want to go to the material design spec, and there's like a typography kind of subsection of that. And that tells you which weight to use and kind of recommended sizes for like all of the different elements in your app.
Okay.
So then on the typography side, another thing that I'm really excited about in Lollipop is finer grain control of the typography. So you can adjust the letter spacing. You can add more space. Like that's good if you're doing very small text, it makes it more legible. Or if you're trying to do kind of like a advertising design thing, you'll pack the letters closer together. And so there's a new API for that, set letter spacing, I think. And there's also a new API for OpenType features. And this gives you access to alternate characters, alternate glyphs in the font, like small caps. Or there's this thing called old style numbers, where numbers kind of look more like lowercase letters, where some of them will go above and some of them will go below. And so you can just specify an OpenType feature for old style numbers.
This is an API on what? This is a text view?
This is the same thing. It's on text view and canvas. And this one definitely does have an XML attribute as well.
Yeah, Tor is happy.
Yeah,
nice.
We should specify. Tor always asks about this stuff because basically Tor is a tool. Someone who cares deeply about tools, and it is far easier to tool design experiences when there are XML attributes as opposed to just code only approaches.
Yeah,
because you can read somebody's layout file or resource file specified in XML, and
we can offer it a nice property sheet customizer and everything.
Right. Yeah. I mean to edit those, but also to consume them, so you
That's
can
right.
load in a source code and understand what the application is doing from XML resources. Doing it from code, kind of an unsolvable research problem. And then once you change the code, then you know it's not a two-way operation. So it is far better, and we've tried to be better about this over time, about having our XML resources map onto the code-based attributes that we have. I don't think we're quite there yet, but I know there was an effort in, I believe it was Jelly Bean, where we actually took a step back and said, okay, here are all these getters and setters that don't have attributes, or which have attributes that are named and behave slightly differently. And
I wrote the script to derive that information.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Tor's team also did a lot of work to expand the tools so that you have these previews, you know, that are not actually through the emulator, so you get much faster feedback. And so we actually do, apply all of the weights and so on and so forth, and these typographic attributes. To the preview so that you can just design on your
The whole computer. Point of layoutlib is that we actually run as much of the framework as we can. Now some of the native libraries are tricky for us, right? So there comes a point at which point we do our own implementation. But the idea is that all the line breaking code and all the stuff that you guys are doing, that is the same thing you get in the tool.
Yeah.
So thank you for making all those refactorings to make that possible.
Sure thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's anything else in text you wanted to talk about. There was that other thing we teased about, which we could discuss.
Yeah,
anything?
We can.
Fonts, text, anything?
We can.
No? There. Going once?
Yeah.
All right, so the other thing that you have been want to do is work with the audio team.
Yeah.
And you gave a talk at I.O. around
this?
Was this 2014 or the year before?
This was 2013.
So well, I should link to that one in the show notes, but about audio and a synthesizer that you wrote for some of the new, MIDI APIs or audio APIs?
Well, it's audio APIs, yeah. Okay. I mean, it does do MIDI, but it just talks MIDI over USB. There's no explicit MIDI support, but it does work. So yeah, I mean, this is basically, this really kind of started as just something that I did for fun. that just I love, you know, electronic music and audio. And so I started writing this synthesizer, which kind of started as a clone of the Yamaha DX7, the kind of
classic.
Yeah.
Let me guess. Like, so you so then you tried it and you pressed C, and then half a second later you heard your tone.
Yeah, that was the problem. That was one of the problems.
So when you're playing along with something, you learn to like press the keys half a second earlier.
Yeah,
it's just we did that on purpose. It's an audio effect. You hear it a lot in Floyd music where they'll have this sort of artistic delay with the note. So
it's cinematic.
Yeah.
So you know, I kind of like had a common experience to a lot of developers that were trying to do Android audio, and I had the advantage that, you know, I was kind of inside Google, and I could go to the audio team and I could say, "What the hell, guys? You know, seriously." And so this kind of started a collaboration just, you know, on my 20% time, which is one of the great perks of working at Google, that you can spend some of your time just playing with things. And so I used that to work with mostly Glenn Kasten on the audio framework team here. And so we kind of, you know, dug really deep into where is this latency coming from? What can we do to improve it? And what can we do for, you know, to give better tools for developers who want to write high-performance applications? And so there's a lot of work that happened and continues to happen at different levels of using real-time threads and, you know, just, you know, having a fast mixer path so that instead of, you know, just being run at the normal priority, it's kind of like, this is the most important thing, you know, happening right now. And it continues to improve. And one of the huge new things in Lollipop is that the real-time thread, this fast path, also works for input, for microphone. Yep. And that is something, if you're doing something like an audio effect where you're processing audio, you know, just the latency was just killer. And it's getting better. And it's with Lollipop, it's to the point where you really can start to use these things in serious audio applications.
So where did you get to with your synthesizer project, though? So first you started submitting bugs and talking to the engineers and working with them on this stuff. And how far did you actually take it?
Well, it's on the Play Store, and it's also an open source project. So I haven't had anywhere near the time that I would have liked to play with it, because Lollipop turned out to be a pretty major effort. On the text side, that whole text thing we were talking about earlier.
And elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, Lollipop was a big release. Yeah. So you know, I have things that are in the works. I have a kind of a Moog-style analog filter emulator that I did in Neon Assembly Code. This is this SIMD where you process four things at the same time. That's in there, but like I haven't wired it together so that it's a whole analog virtual synthesizer yet. The pieces are there. So I'm hoping to get some time to work on that. But
I love the idea that like we started with these sort of painful to use synthesizers because they're basically the plumbing of audio.
Yeah.
Right. You have to turn this dial there, and you do this other thing, and you create this waveform there, and then and somehow you have to have a mental model of how sound works in order to actually get a tone.
Yeah.
Like the one that you have in your mind. And that changed over time, and we made things much easier, and you sort of push these buttons and get these automatic sounds. And now we have these devices that do amazing things, so we're rolling it back 40 years.
Exactly.
And giving you the plumbing knobs and dials.
We're making it so you can simulate those old school devices. But, you know, the sound is just really, you know, it's that classic synthesizer sound. But people use it, and, you know, it's another thing where people, you know, email me, you know, on a pretty regular basis, you know, thanks for that being out there. And I think it's also, if you're developing audio tools, which is, I think, really expanding, you know, a lot now that the platform supports this low latency audio, the devices are getting out there in the field, this is a good time to be, you know, developing audio tools. And that code base is a nice place to start. Because it does kind of follow the best practices about how to get that low latency path, and it also has a pretty good USB implementation, so for the MIDI, so you can plug in your physical keyboard. You're not limited to what the touchscreen can do, you know, any serious synthesizer has to be able to handle that physical keyboard, so, and it's so, a good place to start. That's as I said, it's open source as well.
Oh, it is. Your synthesizer is?
Synthesizer.
Okay, so it's on the Play Store, but it's open source.
Yeah,
okay.
It's both.
Cool.
Yeah.
I will.
And I imagine the latency would depend a lot on the hardware, the specific phone you're using, or phone or tablet or whatever.
Yes, it does. So we've been pushing very hard on the Nexus devices, that we've been really trying to get those to the max.
Or is that a matter of getting the drivers improved, or is it just like a physical limitation, or is it software you can?
So the true answer to that is ridiculously complicated, and like the main thing that you run into is that the power management and the need for low latency audio kind of conflict with each other. The power management is trying to get the phone to go into sleep modes and so on and so forth, so it doesn't just constantly drain your battery, and that's the exact opposite of what you need for audio. So if you are going to implement low latency audio, you have to kind of apply engineering at several different layers. You have to get the audio drivers right. You have to make sure that the power management is not adding random delays, which, by the way, helps system performance as a whole. It's just that audio is really sensitive to that. If you skip 5 milliseconds, that might cause a jank, or maybe not on the screen, but in audio, you will get a glitch.
So the word for jank in audio is glitch?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. So the good news is that the manufacturers are getting the message, and I think that of the latest generation of devices, the kind of 2014 devices, most of those are actually supporting low latency audio now. So I think the chance that users will have these devices, but it is something to be aware of, because if you are deploying on older devices, then some of those are still going to have, unfortunately, pretty poor audio performance.
So I should point out too, like when you said, well, we're trying to make this as good as we can on Nexus devices, like one of the reasons that we do those devices are, I mean, to some extent, reference platforms so that we can understand sort of the market and the technology and the drivers, and we can work with partners to get the base fundamental technology right. Otherwise, if we're completely dependent, if all we do is produce the software and we're completely dependent on other people to do hardware implementations of that, A, they may not care, right? They may be selling devices into a market that doesn't care about audio, so they're not going to pay attention to that, or maybe that manufacturer fixes it for their audience and other manufacturers don't, and then app developers can't depend on it. But if we can sort of raise the bar for the platform overall and say, like in this case, when in Jelly Bean, when these improvements were made, was it Jelly Bean?
The Fast Mixer first shipped in Jelly Bean,
Because I remember part of it, so there was stuff going on in the kernel that we could fix in the platform, but there were also driver improvements that we needed.
Yeah.
And so we exposed new APIs at the driver level that the drivers then needed to expose new capabilities that we could pay attention to. And that's something that we could then learn about, fix on our own platforms, and then tell the manufacturers about, here's how to make better audio on your systems.
Yeah.
Right. So then it's a gradual improvement where we do the work first to sort of fix it at the platform level, and then we work with the partners so that they know what to do to fix it in the overall ecosystem.
Yeah.
If I sort of cast that correctly?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And you know, for something as complex as audio, it does take time for those improvements to kind of diffuse out there, but it certainly is happening.
Excellent. So go out and write a synthesizer, a sound proposition.
Yeah.
And when are you dropping your album?
It's open source, actually.
That's right.
Yeah, no, I just play with the tools. I dabble in the music side, but for me, the tools are kind of, it's just like you. The tools are more interesting than actually doing things, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm on the other side of the music thing. Like, I grew up playing piano, and then I got into keyboards, and I play with bands off and on occasionally, and I have never wrapped my head around the synthesizer thing at all. Like, I have had keyboards where I did some basic stuff with, but for some reason my mind just doesn't want to take on the job of actually understanding all of the audio details. Like, I'm a user at that standpoint. I play the keys, hopefully they sound right. The beautiful thing about pianos is that it is in tune. Even if it's out of tune, you are still the instrument that's in tune in the band, and everyone has tuned to you because there's nothing you can do about it. Tune to my B flat. I don't care what yours sounds like.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit of a tangent. I think we sort of covered the gamut of things that I know of. I don't know if there's anything else you felt like talking about.
Do you have a favorite sample string that you use when you do layout? Like, is it Lorem Ipsum, or is it the Lazy Fox Quick
Brown Fox.
Yeah, so, that's one that has all the letters in it, right?
Yeah, it is. That's a Pangram. So the thing is that because so much of the work that I do is multiple languages, that I usually just end up like pulling down.
Well, you need to come up with like some really long sentence that has all the letters from all the languages,
that
right?
Would
so
be,
it's going to be like some sort of United Nations declaration.
That would be interesting. I mean, usually I go to Wikipedia and just pull you know text from that when I'm testing, you know.
You know, many years ago when I worked at Sun, I worked on this Emacs integration with the debugger, and we got some bugs that basically I ran with Emacs in the Japanese locale because I wanted to make sure there were no English strings leaking through as we pulled the new versions of Emacs for the debugger.
Yeah.
And I got this bug from the Japanese localization center saying, hey, there's this string that's, you know, that's not right. And I was like, looks Japanese to me because I had no idea.
Yeah.
Right. So I just wonder when you pull text off of Wikipedia, how do you know that that's actually like being rendered with the correct font, not some browser bug where it's like random characters.
Yeah. It's, I mean, a lot of it is just practice that I've seen so much incorrectly rendered text that I've kind of picked up, you know, how to spot. You see like combining characters that have the little dotted circle still on them, and that's like a dead giveaway that you haven't applied. So it's just, you know, it's just attention to detail.
And
know,
being really able to speak every language.
Yeah,
on the planet.
That helps a lot too.
I was reminded of a test case that we had. So I helped a little bit in the glyph cache that came up earlier in implementing that and in fixing various bugs that came up over the years. And one of them was that if you shoveled enough new characters through the system, you could blow through the cache and basically bring your app to a standstill because we were just constantly thrashing the cache. We would draw new characters in, they would get flushed out, we'd upload new textures. And the test case for this was a flinging list of text views, each text view of which, like as it recycled view and populated it, it would insert a new Unicode character for the Chinese language.
Yep.
And there's basically like almost infinite number of characters. You fling a list and you would go like one page and it would just stop because, you know, we just blew through the cache already and we haven't even touched the tip of the iceberg for the Chinese language with 4,000 characters more?
There's not a single number. I think our current font, the Nodo, is, I think it's at 40,000 characters for Chinese.
But factor of 10?
This is the problem with, you know, your Pangram, that English is like 26 letters, you know, in two cases. So you can kind of, you know, cover that pretty well. And then, you know, like, you know, a lot of what we do, of course, is just fix bugs. And it's so funny because you'll see like an obscure character and it's like it's got the wrong radicals, you know, and it's subtly slightly wrong. But the one of the great things about, you know, being on Android is that no matter how obscure your problem is, some user will find it and they will let you know.
Yeah. So and they'll tell all their friends to start that issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So we pay attention and, you know, so we're constantly polishing and, you know, I'm pretty happy with what we've got in Lollipop. So,
yeah, that was the surprising thing about this test case was, I mean, it was totally made up because, you know, we're just inserting these random Unicode characters, but it was clear in working with the test case, like, you actually could run into this situation where you're going to thrash the cache in other languages. It's just not something that I thought about when working with it because, you know, well, you know, if we can fit hundreds of characters, what is the problem?
Works
well,
on my
the
computer.
Problem is alphabets with thousands and thousands of characters.
Yeah.
Right. So
actually, that reminds me of a related issue to text layout and rastering. So I swear I saw Roman, or maybe it was you, give a talk about how we made performance much better. But if you take a look at an app like Google Plus, right, where there's different types of fonts, there's like bold fonts for like, or actually Gmail, like there's like bold fonts for the subject, and there's different fonts for the three lines of email preview. And it got much better if you first render all the places in the UI that has the bold text, and then you do like a GL switch, and then you render all it does multiple different passes based on using different fonts because that's better for GL.
Yeah.
But how does that interact with that model I had of, hey, we send all the text down to bitmaps and we paint those?
Yeah. So actually the you know, at the GL level, you know, now we kind of have this unified thing where all of the fonts, you know, get rendered into the same glyph cache. And so at the GL level, it's not really caring which ones are bold and which ones are, you know, normal weight. So, but maybe what you are seeing is that there's this reordering that happens at the GL level
where you know, a lot of times you'll have this pattern where you'll draw a background and then you'll draw text over it, and then you'll draw another background for the next thing in your list view or your conversation view or whatever, and then you'll draw the text, and there's this constant switching back and forth between GL contexts.
I see. So the switching isn't really between fonts. It's really okay.
Yeah. Right.
So as long as you sort of do the text in one pass, that's fine, and that's when you go down into the level of.
Yeah, in particular with the state switch that would happen there, like if you're drawing a background, you're basically drawing a bitmap.
Yeah.
If you're drawing text, you're also drawing from a bitmap, but they're different textures.
Yeah.
Right. So we have the glyph cast textures that we're going to point you at to draw a mesh with the associated textures for the glyphs that we've drawn in there. And if you have a bitmap, that's completely unrelated one. Well, GL doesn't like that that swap between the different textures. There's also different types of drawing operations. So we basically try to, we reorder and we batch all these things to try to do as many similar operations as we can at a time. But specifically drawing a background and then drawing text, reordering it to do it all at once allows us to say, use this texture, now do the following operations.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. I think that was one of the I/O talks, one of the performance talks that I gave with Romeo. We work on that stuff. Someone else actually doing the work on the platform, but yeah.
You just took credit for it.
Which you know, is standard course. So anything incredibly intelligent you want to close with?
No.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you guys. It was a pleasure.